You can make your way tonight, if you will, to 2 Samuel chapter 15. And I've changed the title from what appeared in your bulletin as I've continued to study on this. But we continue our series that we've entitled, The Mask That People Wear. And when I started this study a few weeks ago, I knew I would not have trouble finding examples of those that, should we just say it this way, that are hypocrites in the Bible. You know, some people use as an excuse about the church, well, you know what? The church is just full of hypocrites. Well, frankly, the Bible is just full of hypocrites because this is just humanity. Humanity on display. Now, we shouldn't be, and we need to be changing. Gotcha, got all that. And this is not what God wants, but it's not an unusual place to be. And you recall, we took a week, we had a week last week where we had communion together. So let's remind ourselves the reason we use masks because the word hypocrites that you find in the New Testament is one that comes from the Greek theater, which a hypocrite, Hippocritus, was an actor on a stage. And they would wear these masks to display their emotion, the emotion of the character on the stage. That being the case, they appeared one way, but in actuality were something else. Look, if you will, in chapter 15, and we run immediately into our character for tonight. It says, after this happened, that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. Now, I think I read in the paper that tonight is the Academy Awards thing on TV. I will soon be 57, and I can tell you this will be the 56th consecutive year that I have not watched the Academy Awards on television. It is of no interest to me, and that's no reflection on this year or any year. It's just, you know, they're celebrating movies I haven't watched and don't know anything about, and most of them have content that I probably are not real excited about to begin with. But it is a spectacle, you know, and I suppose I think they cover this live, people walking on the red carpet, getting out of their limousines and their designer clothes and all that. When I read this verse, that's kind of what I at least picture. Here's Absalom, 50 people to go before him. He has this entourage, and we're going to talk about Absalom tonight. And we want to just get into his life and his story. It's fairly well known, but let's see if we can say some things about Absalom. Now, Absalom was one of David's sons, okay? So King David, you understand, had sons. Let's just get some preview there. If you'll bring up the next slide, or actually the title slide. Tonight we're talking about the mask of the hidden agenda, and that's what we're going to see. He had an agenda that was it was below the surface. It was subsurface. He was trying to do something, but outwardly appearing completely different. And we're going to learn some warnings for us, and we're also going to learn some things that we need to avoid in our lives. Okay? Bring up the next slide, if you will. I know you can't see that very well, but this is David's family. If you see the little man at the very top, that's David. And, I mean, in some ways, it's no wonder he has a son like Absalom. Because frankly, we think of the family situations of these people, and frankly, they were messed up. It was not God's way. You remember when Adam was placed in the Garden of Eden, God took one portion out of Adam's side and made one woman and brought them together. That was God's standard. But you understand, he had eight wives. That's the eight in the next line across there, all named. And of course, Michael, remember Saul's daughter was his wife that was taken from him, and then he goes later and gets her back and all that story. And then he also had 10 concubines, which it's even bizarre to even talk about it. They were wives in some sense, but they did not have the legal standing of heirship and so forth that a legal wife would have. So from that, he has many children, and then on down it goes. And of course, over on the other side, over this side, Solomon is the one who follows him as king and so forth. But if you look over on this side, one, two, three down, you see Absalom. Oh, thank you for that little pointy thing. Yeah, Absalom. He had a sister named Tamar. Go over there. Okay, very good. Thank you. My train of thought completely derailed right there. I don't know. I'm glad we're here and we can have fun. Okay, that's all. Thank you. That was helpful, actually. If I ever call for the pointy thing, you'll know what I'm asking for from now on, all right? But I want to just give you a little bit of background, all right? So I'm going to give you a list. Let me show you one more thing, by the way, just before we get too far into the story. Let me show you a picture. In Jerusalem, in the Kidron Valley, there is this structure that is known as Absalom's Tomb. So I just say that to say this. This character that might be sort of minor to us is not exactly minor, particularly to Jewish history. This story stands out because this was a major, major threat in David's life. Now, we don't know for sure. That's what traditionally we are told is Absalom's tomb. Actually, a lot of scholars believe it was built way too late in history to be Absalom's tomb, so we don't know for sure. But I point that out just to say he's a significant character, all right? Let's just give some other backgrounds. If we'll bring up the next list, please. All right, first of all, we understand David had eight wives and many children, and from them he had Tamar, who was a daughter, a full brother, a full sister, I should say, to Absalom. And in chapter 13, this ugly, terrible, frankly disgusting story, I mean, it's just disgusting on every level, but Amnon, that would be Tamar's half-brother, same father, different mother, all right, but a full sister of Absalom, Amnon traps her and rapes her in an incestuous relationship, and how should we say it this way? Absalom is going to bring vengeance to make sure that his now mistreated and abused sister is you know, that it's settled. Nothing happens for quite a while. And then we have in chapter 13 the story that Absalom has a feast and a special time when all the sons of David gathered together. And he had a bunch of people laying in wait, assassins. So at the right time he gives the signal, they jump on Amnon, he's stabbed to death, and he's killed right there on the spot. So David has a dilemma, okay? I mean, he has one son that abuses another sister, another daughter, but this is the king's son. I don't know if he just doesn't want to kill an heir of the king or what, but now he's got one son who kills another son, and it's just a mess. By the way, if you track this back, it all goes back to Bathsheba. After, you remember, after the sin with Bathsheba, and you remember, now this is after he's got eight wives and 10 concubines, all right? Or at least seven at that point. Bathsheba married to Uriah. He sees her. He takes her. He has her. She's carrying his child. Uriah's off out in the battlefield. And by the way, remember what David did? He brought Uriah back and says, "I want you to tell me how the battle is going. Where did Absalom learn this hidden agenda thing that he's about ready to pull?" It sort of comes back on David's head. Now, I know David was a man after God's own heart and all that, but he was also flawed humanity, which gives us pause and gives us some warning. So he kills his brother, and then he flees. He flees to another city outside of Israel. He is there for 3 years. So for 3 years, he's absent from the scene. And then you can read this in these chapters before we get to 15. But basically, through a long period of time, he finally returns to Jerusalem. But while he is in Jerusalem, it is another 2 years that he never sees his father David face to face. So they have been estranged for 5 years, okay? And so that's what takes place. But he returns to Jerusalem. Now, if you go back to chapter 14 for just a moment, I want you to see just a few things in verse 25. And I want to talk mostly about his hidden agenda and what we can learn from it, but you have to understand this. But 25, it says this. Now, in all Israel, there was no one who was praised as much as Absalom for his good looks. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. He was absolutely a good-looking guy. He probably would be walking the red carpet in today's world. Okay, so he was very handsome. He was a handsome man. And we've already talked about his sister Tamar, and I'll put it up right now. But notice you see here, it says that he has a sister, and he will name her Tamar as well. But anyway, verse 26, let me get back to where I was. And when he cut the hair of his head, at the end of every year he cut it because it was heavy on him. I don't know about you, but that seems a little strange to get a haircut once per year. And it was a big head of hair, apparently. But apparently this was one of the things that was just a striking feature of this young man. He had a good head of hair, and he really let it grow, okay? Interesting, that is his source of pride, his source of beauty. Just file this away in your little file cabinet. The very thing when God is done doing what God does, it comes back to that same focal point of his wonderful hair. Verse 27, to Absalom were born 3 sons and 1 daughter, whose name was Tamar. He names his daughter the same as his sister that he tried to avenge by killing his brother Amnon. That kind of tells you that he's not over it yet. And he has more that he wants to do. He doesn't only want to get back at Amnon, whom he's already killed. He wants to get back at his father, whom he blames for all these things happening. It says in verse 28, and Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem, but did not see the king's face. And in the next verses, they finally get back together. Verse 33 tells us this. So Joab went to the king and told him, and when he had called Absalom, he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king. Then the king kissed Absalom. So they finally, after a 5-year estrangement, they are back together. And in chapter 15, we have the launching of this whole plot, that if it were not for God's promise and God's intervention, the next king of Israel would not have been Solomon. It would have been another one of David's sons by the name of Absalom. And King David would have been killed by the forces of his own son in a family-driven coup attempt, we'd say it that way. But God, of course, had other plans and other promises upon David, particularly the Davidic covenant, that through his line would come even the Messiah. So let's get into the story just a little bit, and then we'll break out these points for us. Verse 2. Now Absalom would rise early. This is verse 2, chapter 15. He had these 50 guys, chariot, the whole deal, running before him, chariots, horses. So when he traveled around, it was like a motorcade, okay? Now Absalom would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. Now, remember, when we think biblically about gates, the gate was not just the way you got through the wall into the city. The gate was like the courthouse. It was like the center of government. It's where legal cases were heard. It's where property was transacted. You remember when Boaz goes to make the arrangements to take Ruth to be his wife because there's another kinsman redeemer? They meet at the gate of the city for this whole legal proceeding so that Boaz can marry. We see that other places in Scripture. So on the way to the gate, so people going in to do their business, to do their legal things, he's out there and he cuts them off right before they go in. So it was whenever anyone had a lawsuit, came to the king for a decision, okay, so the king has to decide, the king's going to rule one way or another, Absalom would meet them first. That Absalom would call to him and say, "What city are you from?" And he would say, "Your city is from such and such a tribe of Israel." Doesn't that sound very innocent? "I'm really concerned about you. I want to know where you're coming from." Verse 4, "Moreover, Absalom would say, 'Oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, and I would give him justice.'" Easy thing to say, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't matter what the case is. It doesn't matter who's in the right and who's in the wrong. You could say that to everybody, and I get the impression that's what he did. "Oh, if I were king, I'd rule your way. I mean, you've been mistreated. I don't know." And you get kind of the idea that maybe he was there coming and going after the decision was made and someone coming out. And by the way, any court case, someone's going to be disappointed. At least one person is going to be disappointed. Maybe two people disappointed. But at least one is going to be found against. Right? So he would be out there, "Oh, if I could just be king, everything would be better for you." Look on what happens. Verse 5, "And so it was whenever anyone came near to bow to him, he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him." Now, he was the king's son. So someone would come and pay him honors, the king's son. He would stop him, and in return, he would honor them. "Oh, no, don't you be greeting me. I need to honor you." That's called flattery, okay? That we understand exactly what's going on. "In this manner," verse 6, "Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel." This hidden agenda, this hypocrisy. On the outside, he's acting like, "I love all of Israel. I love all of you. I could fix everything for you. I'm your friend. Don't honor me. Let me honor you." But instead, we're going to find out in just a moment what is going to happen. Verse 7, "Now it came to pass after 40 years that Absalom came to the king." And that probably means Absalom was 40 years old. I don't think he was waiting. I don't think he was doing all this for 40 years, but it's probably an indication of his age, perhaps. "That Absalom said to the king, 'Please let me go to Hebron and pay the vow which I have made to the Lord. For your servant took a vow while I dwelt in Geshur in Syria, saying, If the Lord indeed brings me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord.' And the king said to him, 'Go in peace.' And he arose and went to Hebron." By the way, here's where it gets even worse. He's blaspheming God. He's lying about God. There's no vow. He's not going to worship God. But that's what he tells David. So this is all dishonest. It's all set up from the beginning. Verse 10, then Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigns in Hebron. And with Absalom went 200 men invited from Jerusalem, and they went along innocently, did not know anything. And Absalom sent to Ahithophel, the Gileadite, David's counselor, from his city, from Gihoth, while he offered sacrifices, and the conspiracy grew strong, and the people with Absalom continually increased in number. He's raising an army because he's going to march back to Jerusalem. He's going to run David out and hopefully kill him, and he's going to establish himself as being king. Verse 13, I'm going to read just two more verses, and then we'll get to the end of our points. Now, a messenger said to David, saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. So David said to all of his servants who were with him in Jerusalem, arise, let us flee, and we shall not escape from Absalom. Make haste to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring disaster upon us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. So David himself packs up his family, for the most part, and he flees Jerusalem, and Absalom moves in. And I'm not going to get into all the story, because the part I want to get into is this hidden agenda and what we can learn from it. But I'll give you just a little bit more. He does come. David has to flee. They carry the Ark of God out, but David says, no, the Ark of God didn't come in with me. It goes back because God's will is going to be done. Absalom comes in. And the most, you think of all the hideous things that Absalom has done. You remember we said 8 wives and 10 concubines. David leaves the 10 concubines behind in the king's palace. When Absalom comes in, he pitches a tent on the roof of the king's house, and he goes up publicly behind the tent and defiles all of them. I mean, you talk about just hating his father and hating God and hating Israel and hating anything good. That is this guy. But what do we want to learn tonight is just 4 simple warnings about the mask of the hidden agenda. And that's what we want to look at tonight. Warning number one. There is always a possibility in our dealings with people that someone has a selfish agenda. I know that is nothing new to you. I know that is not shocking to you. I know that might be troubling to you. And it's probably something that every one of us in this room have experienced on some level. And the thing is, and the key word in that phrase is selfish agenda. Absalom was not concerned about Israel. He was not concerned about the 50 guys who ran with him. He's not concerned about the 200 that came out to be the seed, if you will, that grew into the army that was going to march into Jerusalem. He did not care about God. He did not care about right and wrong. He only cared about himself. He was selfish. By the way, that is the natural man in full display. Man has suffered with the plague and the scourge of selfishness, humankind, from the very, very beginning. So I say that. Here's just a warning. Throw this out there. Because remember Jesus says this. He says, when you go out into the world, a world of selfish people, you need to be as, remember what he said? Harmless as doves and wise as serpents. We as God's people have the harmless as doves thing down pretty well. The wise as serpent, sometimes we trip up over that. And I'm not trying to make us skeptical or trying to make us suspicious or conspiratorial, but just understand, you have to take what people say with an understanding that not everybody has your best interest in mind, and that happens. Shortly after I came to Mount Calvary as pastor, I received a phone call. Actually, Stephanie received a phone call, her secretary, and she says, this particular person, she gave me the name. I said, yeah, I sort of recognize that name. But said he would like to, he's been listening to you on the radio. Well, I thought, well, how nice. That he, you know, there's someone out there that listens to the radio program. And he said he's really interested in what you have to say. I should have been getting a clue right then, okay. But, you know, you take people at their word, whatever. And he would like to come and just talk to you about some things from the Bible. I thought, well, okay, we'll make this appointment. He came, and he sits down, and it took me probably about 10 minutes to figure out, because he's written some things and that sort of thing, and finally some background information sort of was refreshed in my mind. But he was looking for an opportunity to come in and teach in our church, teach the Bible in some setting in our church. The problem is the doctrine that he is really excited about sharing is that he has discovered from the Bible that hell is not real. It's just a myth. And he would love to come in and teach us, all of us, all the things that he's learned, that hell is just not real. And it just suddenly dawned on me, I don't think he's listening to the radio show. I don't think he's really excited about my teaching because, you know, even though maybe I don't rail on hell all the time, it is real. And I found myself saying, you know what? If hell isn't real, why don't we just close the church doors? I mean, what's the point? Yeah, well, neither is heaven. It could be just, you know. And the other thing is, Jesus talked a lot more about the dangers of hell than he talked about the glories of heaven when he spoke in the Bible. And I certainly don't want to contradict Jesus on the subject, but it was just a reminder of, like, you got to be careful. And sometimes people who do not have your best interest in mind will come with a hidden agenda. Number two, there's always a possibility, I hate to say this, but I am, there's a possibility that you and I may have a selfish agenda too. Because if we are walking in the flesh and not walking by the Spirit, we can fall right, we can be Absaloms right along. But what God calls us to do is this. This is a New Testament principle. Speak the truth in love. Speak the truth in love. Do it lovingly, do it compassionately, do it kindly, do it consistently. But at the same time, you can't compromise on the truth because it is the truth that ultimately will set people free. And what we need to do is constantly and frequently come to the realization to just say, God, I need you to check my heart. We talked about it when we were gathered around for communion last Lord's Day evening, that we need to examine our hearts to make sure that our heart's intention are not about us. Our heart's intention is not about us making a scene for ourselves, having people think I'm great, that I get what I want, that I'm gonna control people like Absalom did. I want to set everything right according to my standards. And before we throw too many stones Absalom's way or other people's way, understand this is a possibility. Just be warned. Warning number two. Someone could be building a coalition. I mean, they may sound innocent, but this is what you see him doing. Oh, tell me about your court case. Oh, if I were king, I'll tell you how I would rule. You know, let me honor you. You're from that city. Oh, I love the people of that city. And he just buttered them up along, because he's building a coalition. It says right there in the text, it says this is how he stole the hearts of the people. Verse 6, so Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Number two, the second part of that warning, everyone shouldn't rather be building the kingdom rather than the coalition. How do we fight this possibility of factionalism and building kingdoms and little enclaves for themselves? We need to call ourselves and call each other back to serving the kingdom of the Lord Jesus Christ. That we call each other back to be serving a higher, nobler, more divine setting and purpose than just ourselves. And that's what God calls us to. You know, fortunately now, I've been in the ministry for 30-plus years now, and I remember as a young man, I couldn't tell these kind of stories because people would know who I was talking about, okay? But now I can tell stories that happened years back, and some of these people are already in heaven, so, you know, I can tell stories. But in the first church I pastored, there was a particular man who came in. He was a tall, good-looking man. I'm not trying to make a comparison to Absalom, but he was just kind of a striking figure, right? And he had had a really bad experience in the church that he had previously left. And it probably was, maybe he overreacted, but he had a bad situation. Sometimes people get hurt in church. It does happen. But I finally found out, just even in spite of how he treated me, and I remember he had Julie and I over and our kids over to his house and all this sort of thing, but he didn't trust pastors. He was suspicious of anybody who stood behind one of these things and preached. And I found out that one of the things he was doing was going around and sowing seeds of suspicion about everything that pastor was saying. Is that really what he meant? Is that really what we should do? And it became not a horrible thing, but it was a very hurtful thing because someone was sneaking around quietly and building a coalition. I'm going to share some practical points at the end, and we'll address how you overcome that. Warning number three, someone may have a goal of bypassing God-given authority. Here's the whole thing with this whole situation. It was God himself who'd selected David to be king. He sent Samuel to Jesse's house and made sure that he anointed one person and one person only, and that was David, and that was God's choice. David was not perfect, we've already said that, but he was God's choice. You remember, David had been anointed a long time before he ever became king. David had opportunity to kill Saul on more than one occasion. Saul was trying to kill David. I mean, everybody would have said, self-defense! Go for it, David. But in both instances where he could have easily killed Saul, he said, I'm not going to raise up my hand, my arm, against the Lord's anointed. God's going to have to take him out, not me. But that was not Absalom's situation. He was going against God-given authority. And we just need to understand that sometimes is the hidden secret agenda of people. I'll do what I want, no matter what anybody else thinks. Again, in the church long years ago, the church had made a particular set of decisions, and the church was a congregational government like we are, that significant things we vote on. Okay, that's the way we do it in the Baptist church. So the congregation decided, under the authority structure of the church, this is what we're going to do. But there was a particular man in the church, I remember, he was not real happy about this decision. And he invited me to his home. And I was a young guy, I was probably 25, 26 at the time. So I went to his home one evening, kind of late, it's getting dark, and he pulls out a piece of paper and he writes something on there. And he slides it across this little desk that he was sitting at. And he says, I just want you to see how much money I give to the church in a year's time. And I remember saying to him, I'm not interested in seeing how much you give to the church in a year's time. I said, I don't want to know what anyone gives except me. There's this principle that says the right hand should, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, three or four weeks ago, don't let the right hand know what the left hand's doing. Because I don't want to be swayed or impressed or under-impressed by what anybody gives. I don't want to know. That's not. Long story short, he was trying to do an end run around the authority structure and the decision-making of the church because I've given I didn't look at the paper, was probably a large sum of money. But it just was a reminder, you know what, there's authority structure in place. We have a way of making decisions. We have the things that God says in the Word of God. We honor the things that God honors. And just be understand, there's always the possibility. Just tune up your hearing so that you know that there might be someone. What do we do? Well, here's the response. Everyone should have a goal of furthering God-given authority. And in this case, David was to be the king as long as God gave him life. That was God's business. So to leave that alone, give that to God-given authority. Warning number four, a hidden agenda leads to group disaster. Now, I don't want to spend too much time, but over in chapter 18, you can just flip there and you can kind of gaze over these verses. But it finally comes to a battle in chapter 18, and it tells us, verse 18:7, the people of Israel were overthrown there before the servants of David, and a great slaughter of 20,000 took place there that day. For the battle there was scattered over the face of the whole countryside, and the woods devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. The hidden agenda, the person that's trying to appear spiritual, or trying to appear nice, or trying to influence God's people, and Paul describes it this way. He says, be on your guard. In Acts chapter 20, he calls the leaders of the Ephesian church to meet him as he's on his way to Jerusalem. And he says, I just want to warn you. After my departure, he says, ravenous wolves are going to come in and they're going to attack the sheep. I don't know where that is or who. I don't have any sense that that's going on. But if it's a warning that Paul gives and the Word of God gives, we need to give it every once in a while. Just be on guard. be on guard, because it will lead to disaster. It did for Israel. Not only that, a hidden agenda leads to personal disaster. And it says in verse 9, here's the end of Absalom. Then Absalom met the servants of David. Absalom rode on a mule. The mule went under a thick boughs of a great tenebeth tree, and his head caught in the tenebeth, and he was left hanging between the heaven and the earth, and his mule, which was under him, went on. You just wonder if he didn't have that big head of hair if his head got stuck in a tree that day, right? And then Joab comes, and a man of Joab comes and said, I saw him hanging there. He didn't want to kill him because David had given an order not to lay a hand on him. But Joab is not so kind, verse 14. And Joab said, I cannot linger with you. And he took three spears in his hand and thrust them through Absalom's heart. And then they blew a trumpet and the battle was over. It's interesting that here's something about David's heart. David, rather than say, I'm glad that rascal's gone, David later prays, he would have rather died in the place of Absalom. That's his heart as his cry for his son. It was a tragedy on every level. Let me just give you four, five, six quick practical helps here, and then we'll be done. Some practical helps, practical stuff. Just kind of extracting from it. Number one, if you can't talk about it openly, be on guard. If someone has to say, we need to have a secret conversation, I don't want anyone else to hear. Now, there might be things that are confidential. I'm not talking about that, or things that need to be discussed, that need to be kept confidential. But I'm talking about, here's what's going on. Here's the plot. Here's the conspiracy. Here's what's going on. If it can't be talked about openly, because most things, big picture things, things of we as a church or we as families, it really should be spoken of openly. So that's just a little warning sign. Number one, beware of the us versus them mentality. When you start hearing about, they said this. It's interesting, all the things that they say. You ever noticed that? Oftentimes I want to interrupt, well, who are they? Who are all those they people that keep talking that we never know who they are? But when you come to that might be a sign that someone has a hidden agenda. Listen for mentions of who someone is or what someone has done. When someone tries to leverage their position or leverage their activities, that might be a sign that something's going on that shouldn't be there. That was Absalom's approach. Just take that as a warning. Listen to the overuse of personal pronouns. I, me, we, us. Sometimes it probably wouldn't hurt to talk about or just take note of how many times people say I in their sentences. Some people have eye trouble, right? It's I. That may be a warning that would help you. You find that with Absalom. And we talked a little bit about this morning. Notice if someone makes themselves the hero of every story they tell. I mean, Absalom, that's the Absalom. Boy, if I was the king, I mean, you'd walk out with a bundle of cash. If I were the king, things would be better. If I was the king, he had a political campaign going there. And lastly, note the use of the phrase, if only. Oh, if only this were different. If only that were changed. If only we could do this or not do this. Now, that's just a very simple list, but I would just encourage you to, just as a safeguard for you personally, be on guard. I remember one time I was standing in the checkout line at Kroger's. This was back, Julie and I were freshly married. And some guy turns around and strikes up a conversation. He was a friendly sort. And that sort of thing. Well, I don't know how he got my phone number, but later I get a call from this guy. He said, I met you at Kroger's. And you just seem like a really nice guy. I don't, that should have been my first warning, right? I'm just a guy buying milk and bread at Kroger's. I mean, just. And he started, I'd really like to meet you and talk to you. And I said, well, just tell me what this is all about. What's you after? He said, well, I'm looking for sales representatives for my particular product line and blah, 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 blah. Okay, got it. Now, that was nothing immoral. If someone sells that particular product line, that's your business. But it's the approach of, I'm not anything special. I'm just the next guy in line at Kroger's. Okay, that's all I am. So I just say that to be on guard, that we need to make sure that we do. There's a particular episode from Abraham Lincoln's life where someone was asking him in the midst of the Civil War, "Mr. President, do you think God is on your side?" And this was his quote. He said, "Sir, my concern is not whether God is on our side. My greatest concern is to be on God's side, for God is always right." What a great statement. Here's how we just counter all of this. And yeah, there are wolves around, and sometimes they even pull on sheep's clothing to disguise themselves. Be warned. But for us, make sure your agenda is God's agenda. Make sure your agenda is God's agenda. Don't worry about whether God's on our side, but we want to be on His side. And may we walk in a way that, knowing that there are people who put on their masks, may we be people who make sure we wear no masks. And may God, as we lean on the Holy Spirit to guide us and protect us from those who wear them in our world, may God help us to do that.